Hello, Thomas. How are you doing? We are still here in Hotel Legoland. You're in sunny, sunny Billund.
We are. I'm very comfortable chairs.
Very comfortable chairs. You formed a groove in that chair, I believe.
One amazing guest after another. We just spoke to...
Jonathan Smith.
Yes, we did. And now we're speaking to...
Mike Bethel.
Hello.
Hello. Would you like to introduce yourself, sir? I believe you don't need no introduction, but
that was very
great
kind.
English.
It's cool. Yeah, I'm Mike Bethel. I'm a game developer. I made Thomas Was Alone, which some people seem to like. I'm now making a game called Volume. But yeah, I've been making games for a while now. Very strange.
Yes.
How do you start doing something like that, making games?
When you make a game, is the cynical answer. No, but it's true. Is basically, that's the thing, is the second you start making games. So I started making games, when I was about 12, 13 on my computer, and I kind of ended up going to university to do a degree in it.
Uh-huh.
And then kept making games, and yeah, one of the little flash games I made got me my first job, kind of quite a few years ago now, and worked my way up through the ranks.
I made a flash game once, I was just telling Matthew.
Was it good?
It was about picnicking, and your family deciding how much cake to take on a picnic.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it was for kids, it was on my animation course. Yeah. But yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, actually, Mike, you started your kind of... forte into gaming by playing educational games, right?
I did.
That was a great segue.
Yes,
wasn't
that was
planned.
A good segue. Yes. Yeah, no, I did. I wasn't really allowed video games as a kid. Nothing fun. I started off kind of playing, Apogee. Apogee did a bunch of educational games. They did, I remember Word Rescue was a game about a caterpillar or a worm or bookworm who would collect letters of simple words.
Yeah.
And it was an awful, awful puzzle platformer that I remember playing way too many times through. So that was kind of my start. I remember my dad managed to smuggle home Doom once, which blew my mind as a kid. Very educational games focused.
Terrifying, isn't it, Doom? As a kid, I thought it was terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
I did. At least.
I have a really distinct memory of my friend Daniel, he was very into his PC gaming, whereas I was a lonely console plebeian at the time.
Mm.
And I still am. It makes me sad. But he had this full setup and a really top spec rig for the time and surround sound in his gaming room and stuff. And we played Doom 3, and I've never been more terrified in my life. I was like 14, 15
Doom
at the
3.
Time, just freaking out. You're clanking pipes behind me and stuff.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Well, on the subject of educational games, before we move on, I played something which sounded a little bit like the one you just mentioned, but it was like a side-scrolling shooter where you were like a helicopter, and you were shooting stuff and collecting letters.
Yeah.
I don't know if that rings any bells.
To be honest, I think that was the thing at the time, was that they would take any successful kind of game and add the capacity to pick up letters to it, and then kind of sell that to parents like mine, saying this is educational, this will teach a child how to spell.
Did your parents ever think about getting you a CDI for educational purposes?
No, I never got the CDI. My girlfriend had a CDI growing up. I think my mother-in-law actually has it in her home
I
still.
Have one. Yeah.
Not been used for anything. Although she also has my old Xbox, which is her DVD player.
Always
very nostalgic when she puts on a DVD and I'm in the house and I see the Xbox startup screen.
Is this the original Xbox?
My original Xbox.
She had a remote for it.
Yeah, I've got the remote for it. When I got
cheap
the 360, I gave that to her because her DVD had just broken. I was like, you can play DVDs on this. So as far as she's concerned, it's a... It's a DVD player with a very aggressive startup screen, basically.
Yeah.
I tried to do that to my parents when I moved over here. I was like, well, I'm not going to take my PS3 kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
You have a Blu-ray player now. Like, they nicked my TV. I was like, well, you may as well watch high-definition film and stuff.
Yeah.
Came back 6 months later. It was upstairs. They were like, come figure out how to work it. We've gone back to the DVD player.
My parents used the PS3 back home. Yeah, they got a 60 gig. They could even play PS2 games if they wanted to. But they watch
do
films.
They?
No, they just watch
films. Exactly. I have weird memories of educational games. I remember playing some kind of game with a castle, and I remember a cartoon dragon in it, and you had to, ringing bells.
Are you talking about Granny's Garden? Are we talking about BBC? Was this a BBC? No, you're too young, aren't you?
No, but I had that at school.
Right, so you had the witch had caught you with the image that would come up when you.
Yeah.
That was the first. It wasn't that game, but there was another game for the BBC Micro that I remember that allowed you to make levels. It was like a text adventure game.
Okay.
And you could build rudimentary levels for it and kind of place rooms and, you know, go north, go east, kind of text commands, level design.
Yeah.
And I remember that was probably the first game I ever edited, basically, which was, I never made anything good, obviously, because I was a child. I had no idea what I was doing, but I did some fun stuff with it. That was probably the one where I realized video games were made by people, not computers.
Ah, yeah. We were actually talking about this with Jonathan just before you arrived, and obviously Sam, his son, making Space Pants.
Which, have you played it?
Yes.
It's really good, isn't it?
It is very good.
Like, on the one hand, you're like, you know, I remember when I was, because Sam was telling me about it over dinner yesterday, and, I'll be honest, 12-year-old telling you that they've made a game. I was always impressive that he made a game, but my expectations were low, and then I actually played it, and it is a solid, really fun little kind of progressively more challenging game. I really
thought unique the idea that these obstacles come from the center of the screen, rather than it's kind of like an endless runner.
It
like
is an endless runner, yeah
but
the,
it, the way it's formulated,
a persistent endless runner. Really, really good idea and really beautifully presented. Like the polish, the level of polish on there, the way it uses sound. I was very impressed by it.
Yeah.
I want it to become a hit. So that's my new kind of mission, is to make that game.
Well, we're on our way with that, aren't we? With Lego.
I think you guys are perfectly placed at the epicenter of this to make Space Pants the hit that it deserves to be.
We'll have hashtag Space Pants t-shirts.
Hashtag Space Pants. Yeah. Well, actually, I found out as I searched Twitter, Space Pants means something else as well in America.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Maybe Space Pants game.
Space Pants game. Hashtag Space Pants game. That's good.
Yes,
I like
let's
that.
Go with that. Okay, cool. But yeah, just this idea that younger kids are actually being able to make games, and like just the fact that the technology's there. And like when we talk about our profession, me and Thomas designing minifigures, when I talked about them to my nephew's friends and kind of say, like, oh well, I designed the minifigures, just that spark of recognition as a child kind of realizes, oh god, people design
that's
these
a
things.
Job that people have.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it demystifies it, right? Like if every kid for free could download a piece of software to their computer that allowed them to make a minifig that was as good as one that came off of your factory's line, that would be very exciting for kids. And that's the situation we now have with video games, that the tools I use are completely available for free to kids. Volume is being made in Unity, and a kid can download a free copy of Unity as long as they've got a computer, and just in theory start making a game of that scale. In theory, obviously, in most cases, it's going to be smaller projects. And that's where Space Pants kind of works. It is a very small, concise game. But, Sam's gone over it enough times that it's very polished.
Agreed.
I'd not heard of the Game Maker program that he'd used to
He's
make
He's Game Maker. Yeah, that's well, that's actually Game Maker. I guess the two most famous games made in Game Maker are Hotline Miami and Gunpoint. Have you played Gunpoint, stealth game?
No, I haven't played.
That's really good. Game by Tom Francis, that's absolutely fantastic. But those are both made in Game Maker.
Wow.
And everything Vlambeer. Vlambeer?
All of
their games.
Super Crate Box.
Exactly, all their games made in, I believe they're still using Game Maker. I think Nuclear Throne's Game Maker, but they're all using Game Maker as well.
That's amazing.
It's great engine, but very, very easy to get into, which is what's crucial here, is that kids can pick it up and start playing. They're not going to make Mario immediately. But that's the only limitation, is their imagination and their experience, and that they can learn. It's not a technological hurdle, which is great.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yes, I guess we should talk about your game, which is also made in Unity.
It's not as good as Space Pants. Space Pants, Space Pants, Space Pants.
Yeah. Space Pants, Space Pants. I was actually going to say, Space Pants reminds me a lot of Super Crate Box. It's kind of got that feel of...
I described it. It makes me think of McPixel meets Cannibalt. It's got that kind of silly... Have you played McPixel?
I am playing McPixel.
It's a very strange... It's a MacGyver kind of adventure game that happens very fast. But it's very, very silly the same way. Mm. So sorry, my game. We're talking about my game.
Sorry, you got distracted.
Okay. No, that's cool.
Thomas was alone.
He was.
I could make the terrible, terrible joke of Thomas not being alone, but I did that on the second podcast.
You were one of the first games to feature on this podcast when we started it like 50 episodes ago.
This is the 56.
I made a little banner for it, and I drew. It wasn't hard to do the squares, but
it
was a really strong graphic for our second one, and it was a magical experience playing Thomas Alone for myself. Very fresh.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've heard a lot of the same sort of praise. You know,
a million people can't be wrong, right?
Well, history would disagree with that theory. I think there's been a few cases where a million people have definitely been wrong.
Yes.
But no, yeah, it's cool. It's weird because I just made it in my living room. Thomas Was Alone was made on a computer that is now, I still have it, I don't use it day to day, but that was the computer I bought with my first paycheck in industry.
Okay.
So when I my very first job, a company called Blitz Games, and which unfortunately has closed down since. But they were based in Leamington Spa, and I remember the first paycheck I got from them as a junior designer like 8 or 9 years ago now. I walked into the Mac store, the Apple store, and bought a Mac.
Yeah.
And that was the computer that Thomas Loan was made on about 4 years later. It's still sat in the corner. It doesn't work very well. You can't make anything on it now. But yeah, so it's always weird to me that many people have played it, basically, because you make a game on your computer, and because of the wonder of copy and paste and the ease with which things can get distributed, suddenly it's a game that a million people around the world have played, which is ridiculous.
And as you said, you made it in your house pretty much over 24 hours, right? You kind of set yourself...
The initial prototype was 24 hours. Yeah. The full game took 2 years of evenings and weekends. But yeah, it was basically my girlfriend was out of town and I wanted something to do. And I'd heard about game jams. I'd never done a game jam before. It appealed to me, but I was kind of a bit nervous about doing it with other people around because I was a bit scared I'd make something rubbish. So I set myself the goal of doing it at home, kind of privately. And yeah, I was really lucky. The first thing I made for a game jam was Thomas Was Alone, and it found an audience as a flash game, and I kind of took it forward.
Cool. I guess you posted that online then afterwards and then kind of saw the response to it. Was that what drove you to make the game afterwards?
Yeah, well, that and Ego. I put it on Kongregate, which is a big kind of flash portal. And yeah, it got, I think it was about 100,000 people in a weekend played it. It was a free version, so that's not incredibly impressive, but I remember thinking that's working for some people. And there's some very nice comments there, and it just made me think, well, actually, maybe this is something that's worth, you know, continuing with and developing on there. I moved to Unity and made a much more polished, refined version of that game.
Cool. And I, as you said, evenings and weekends, were you still working at Blitz then?
So when I started, no. So I was at Blitz when I made the Flash prototype. And then my friend started a company called Boss Studios in London and recruited me. And basically at my interview, they said, well, you know, we'd love you to work for us, but we also know that you're making Thomas Was Alone and you can keep making that. So please, you know, come to our company, make stuff for us, and we're going to totally assume that you're going to go home and work on this game, and we know you're going to quit after 2 years because your game's going to come out.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's pretty much the best job offer I could ever have. And it was basically, so whenever we did kind of, whenever I was in training or in review process, it was never, you know, where do you see yourself in this company in 4 years' time? It was always, okay, so when you quit, you're going to need this skill. And all this stuff. So they really kind of nurtured me towards that goal. While in the evenings and weekends, I was, you know, coding away, trying to make this game work.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, I guess then you've kind of had all perspectives in the industry kind of thing. You've worked at a studio with a lot of people working in it, then you worked at a small studio, and then you've done the independent thing yourself as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do those experiences differ for you?
To be honest, well, the actual act of making a game is always the same. You're staring at a computer screen hoping to God that the thing actually works.
Yeah.
But it's been interesting. The big studio experience was amazing because I was surrounded by geniuses. You know, I was working with people who'd been making video games for 30 odd years, you know, like real people who were there since the beginning. That was an amazing, to be able to lean across and talk to someone who was making games for the BBC Micro and learn from them and pick up stuff from them was incredible and awesome. The smaller studio, there was a faster pace to it because there were less of us and we had no money, so we had to rush to get stuff done. And there was a real sense of kind of a very tight-knit kind of development community. But then on my own is obviously very scary, absolute freedom. I can make whatever I want. But I'm entirely reliant on myself kind of financially. So if I make the wrong call, then, you know, I'm in trouble. So it's a lot of different pros and cons in each different place, but I'm happy with how it's working out.
Cool. Well, seems to be going well anyway.
So far. We'll see. I mean, we'll see in time. Yeah, touch wood. But it's, I've been very lucky. Thomas Was Alone was a hit, which means I have a nice war chest now that I can kind of spend a few years hoping that I can have another hit, basically.
Cool, man. So where did the idea of Thomas come from? Like, did you just kind of think to yourself, hey, I want to do a bit of a quirky puzzle platformer? Or
yeah, that was basically it, to be honest. It was looking around. I was, you know, played Braid, hadn't played Limbo yet, but kind of had seen some of the early stuff of Limbo. World of Goo was around, so I knew that there were these people called indies that made little games in one or two person or three person teams. Yeah. And that kind of blew me away. As someone who only knew how to make games with 50 people, the idea that these people were going off making their own things was very enticing, was very exciting, because I was a cog in a machine.
Yeah.
Lovely job, lovely people, but I was working out where that crate was going to be placed in a level. Yeah. I didn't get to decide what the game was, you know. So there's something very attractive about having that level of control. So I kind of looked at those games and thought, I want to be an indie game developer. That's a cool thing. I was jealous of them, really. So I did. I went and I made stuff, and puzzle platformer was a good hook to hang my hat from. I knew that I could probably make a game that would feel decent to run around and jump in. And if you can make a game where you run around and jump, you've basically got a game at that point. If you can just work out your kind of gimmick on that, your twist, and in Thomas Was Alone, the twist is that there's multiple characters with different jump heights and abilities, suddenly you start to pull together a game, and there's an audience for it. Thomas Was Alone kind of hit in the golden age of the indie puzzle platformer. Mm. There's not so many of them now. It kind of, there was a point in time where that game could find an audience, and I hit it kind of accidentally perfectly.
I still think that it's a very unique game, though. And I mean, we are in an age now where narrative-driven games are getting more commonplace. I mean, obviously, the Portal springs to mind of a puzzle game that involves a narrative. Mm-hmm. I mean, Supergiant Games, and they work on Bastion, and then to a lesser extent, I guess, Transistor as well. Was that a distinctive choice for you? Like,
It was kind of an accident again, like, and it's been a series of lucky accidents. I didn't set out with Thomas Was Alone to do a story game, but I think what happened was almost naturally, because I was trying to write a good story, because honestly I thought we had to. Like, I knew there was story in games, and I played enough of them. And it kind of, I then was like, well, I don't know how to write anything, I'm not a writer. So I went and read a bunch of theory books about how you tell stories and what story structures are. And kind of went, okay, so that's kind of the obvious answer. So I'll use all of that stuff, and I'll put that into a game, and then that'll be a good enough story, and people will be okay with it. I didn't realize that the stuff I was reading and the stuff I was doing would be in any way interesting to people. I thought it was going to be just a kind of run-of-the-mill, kind of get-you-through-the-game thing. But it turned out that actually the stuff I was doing wasn't as obvious. That it wasn't the idea of characters who go through journeys and arcs is actually quite rare in video games, and it was therefore seen as awesome. And honestly, it was just because I didn't know any better, because I went and I read some books about the way filmmakers tell stories, and somehow that led to something good.
Yeah. Yeah. The way you implemented it was really good. You know, I'm not one for cutscenes myself. I like the game keep flowing, and for me that was the best where you could have done it.
I felt
and the way the game kind of builds up as well from the beginning, when you've just start with the one, and then you gather the, and how you introduce the abilities and such. I'm just saying how much I like Thomas Was Alone now.
I like this question. It's good, carry on.
But I was gonna say, you got the perfect voice to do the voiceover.
Yes,
because that is a big part of the success, I think, of how the story's told.
Absolutely.
That voice really fits. And Danny Wallace.
Yes.
Good job, I got that right. But yeah, I was familiar with Danny Wallace, and I thought, is that his voice when I played the game? And obviously I was correct, but yeah, that was a great accomplishment getting him on board there.
No, it was awesome. It was one of those things where I kind of wrote the script and I knew I wanted kind of a very British tone to it. I knew I wanted kind of a friendly storyteller tone. So when I was writing it, my kind of sources that I was kind of using as stylistic touchstones were Douglas Adams and Danny Wallace. I was listening to a bunch of Danny Wallace audiobooks and trying to get in that tone of that way of telling a story, because Danny is just the world's best storyteller. And then when I had the script written, I went out and tried to find voice actors and I searched high and low for someone who could have the same kind of personality and character as Danny in the delivery, and everyone who did it sounded wrong. It didn't work as well. And then I just managed to find Danny's email address on a slightly creepy fan site. And
those exist.
Those totally Danny exist. Wallace. Yeah.
Is that based around like the Yes Man thing?
No, there was. There's a community of people who really like celebrities and finding out their email addresses. So I managed to basically get his personal email address. I just emailed him saying, "Dude, you're awesome. Here's the script. Here's a build of the game as it was back then. I know you're probably never going to read this, but you're a genius, and I think you'd be great for it." And I got a reply in like half an hour. Because what it turns out is that the dude, he's a massive gamer, which I knew, but I'd forgotten that his first job as a writer was actually he wrote for I think PC Format. Bunch of different games magazines were his first jobs. He was a video games critic. So when he got taught, when someone sent him something about a game, he played the game and he liked the demo I sent him and wanted to be a part of it. But he's a massive video game nerd, and that's why he's in Assassin's Creed, is because he managed to get a ticket to the Games BAFTAs years ago and just harassed an Ubisoft person to get a part in a video game. And it's cool that it's come full circle. Now, of course, he's won the BAFTA for Thomas Was Alone, which is a nice conclusion to that story.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I mean, obviously, his narration is a big part of it, but I think you're right in the characterization of what just are shapes at the end of the day. And I mean, it was very eye-opening for me, as someone who designs characters, by just this simple hint of narrative can anthropomorphize anything. It can just shape meaning. I mean,
well, I can't take credit for that. That's millions of years of human evolution, is that we look for it, right?
Yeah.
Humans look out into the world and try and see faces and people. That's why we keep seeing Jesus in shower curtains. You know, that's very important. That's something that we as humanity look for. So you can take a rectangle or a shape or a circle with two dots and a squiggle, and we see a face because we're looking for it. We're designed to look for it. So that was cool. That was a fun thing to try and to do that with something as simple as with just a rectangle. So what I'm saying is basically your job is unnecessary.
Great.
You don't
need
minifigs. Just put a brick in the box. It's fine. Yeah.
So you talked about earlier, you gave a talk for us here at LEGO, and just kind of this broad idea of characters and how yourself, when you were growing up with toys, you talked about Transformers as well.
I did.
Just kind of this
a brave thing to do in front of a room full of Lego people.
That mostly
a lot of
are
us
fans.
Are
of Transformers.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair.
We're all the same around. But just this idea of broad character strokes you were kind of talking about, and how Autobots and Decepticons, and just the idea of like out of the box you have a good guy and you have a bad guy. Was that a conscious thing with your character design in this game? Like when you have Chris, who's kind of got this Napoleon complex, who's kind of got a heart of gold underneath it. And my favourite moment of the game is Claire's introduction, just when the level starts falling away, and it's just kind of like everything's sits up, everything's going down, and then just that spark where she's like, I'm not dead, I should be dead, I'm amazing, I'm a superhero.
Yeah.
And then, as you said earlier, it just goes on to do heroic things. Was that something out of the box you underachieved, so you could kind of nail down these archetypal characters and then build a narrative around?
Yeah, well, my job as a storyteller in a video game is not to tell you a very stringent, strict narrative. I don't think that's my role. What my role is to create the surroundings by which you can tell your story. I'm not going to tell you, go over there, then do that, then do that. But if I tell you that these two characters don't get on, that's going to that gives a layer of meaning to your actions in the game. It's informative to what you're going to do when you play through that level. You don't feel constrained by it. You're not just an actor I'm telling to run around. But it provides context, I guess, is my point. So yes, and that's something that always for me with, Lego's a brilliant example, that you have all these licenses, you have all these really established characters that you play with. But when I'm playing with those characters, I'm not recreating the movie. I'm doing my own thing. I'm using the fact that I know Legolas is fast and good with a bow and arrow and has kind of a cool relationship with Gimli, but I'm not reproducing scene 27 of Lord of the Rings.
No, of course not. That's why a script doesn't come in the box.
Exactly. Yeah, instructions do. Yes. but yeah, so it's cool.
Well,
I think that's important. That's important, and that facilitates me having fun through the context that is provided by those characters. So it's getting that balance right, especially for video games.
So I just made a comment about instructions not coming in boxes anymore. It's just one of those little gripes that niggles at me. You know, you buy a new game and you don't get any instructions. It's getting empty box.
I suppose it's to save money, right? It used to be, what really annoyed me was it used to be that those manuals in boxes had the credits list. And I've never had, I got into the industry right at the tail end of PS2, which was the exact moment that they stopped doing manuals. Yeah. So I don't think I've ever had my name printed in a manual. And it was like the dream of all throughout the, studying to become a game designer was to have my name in the manual for a video game. Oh. And I didn't get there in time.
Oh.
Heartbreaking.
Oh.
Heartbreaking.
I used to do Ubisoft with Child of Light and do like a collector's edition.
Boxed edition, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got your name on a BAFTA.
Yeah, exactly.
I've not won a BAFTA.
You know?
No.
Oh.
No. Danny has. Danny won a BAFTA for Thomas, but I've been nominated, but I've not won one.
Sorry, yeah.
That's okay. I won a Writers Guild Award, so that's cool.
Well, that's good. You get your name on that?
Say again?
You get your name on that?
Yeah, etched in glass, so it's very cool. That's on my shelf in pride of place, next to my Lego collection.
If you want, I know a guy who knows a guy. I'm sure we can get you a BAFTA. We'll have to write it on with marker, but it'll be fine.
Yeah.
So, the shapes themselves... Was that a conscious choice to begin with? Were you just kind of like, okay, I'm going to give this narrative two shapes, or were they a placeholder for something else? Or
They started off as placeholders, so very much like in the original prototype, they were specifically like, I'll change these out, but I've only got time for a rectangle. What was really interesting through development was every time I tried to change them to something else, it made the game worse. If I changed them to humanoid, suddenly you couldn't tell where their feet were. You couldn't tell what their bulk was. You couldn't fit two characters on their head because their head would have to be really strangely wide. Mm. And even I pulled back and I was like, okay, so there'll be people, but there'll be people in like rectangular suits, like space astronauts, yeah, kind of walking around in these cube suits. I thought, oh, that's really cool. But then the second you start playing with that, you realize, well, it's just messy and it looks ugly and you don't really know what's going on. Everything I did that moved away from that kind of beautiful simplicity of a rectangle broke it. So while I experimented with loads, about halfway through development, I was like, no, this is a rectangle game. And at that point you go, okay, so if it's going to be a rectangle game, let's make it the best rectangle game we can. And at that point, I started reading Bauhaus and Mondrian and just loads of, and just like, how can I get this looking gorgeous? And it is just rectangles. So that informed it.
Is there like a theory to the colours you use for the characters? Is that all like researched, or did they just work well for the character? Or is that to do with their personality?
Did you do a Breaking Bad style, is what he's asking.
What's Breaking Bad style?
There's this crazy theory in Breaking Bad that as you watch the series, like Walter is always in green, and like there's shades of the clothes the character are wearing depends on their emotional state, and Walter gets more and more evil as the series goes on, he starts wearing black and like duller tones and all this kind of stuff.
I'll have to watch it again. It wouldn't surprise me. That's cool color theory. In Thomas, it was really the red was arbitrarily chosen for Thomas for the original prototype, and then my long-time collaborator Daz Watford just came up with a palette around that. I don't remember ever kind of choosing a color. There are a few places. So James, for example, is the anti-gravity Thomas, and he is the absolute opposite color to Thomas because they are the same but opposite in gravity, so they're the same but opposite in color. I know that I wanted the later characters to all be shades of gray because they're changed by color triggers and kind of get shapes on them, so they had to have kind of a blank slate. But no, I never kind of decide this character. Well, there's some. So Claire's blue because she floats in water, so you get that relationship. So there are certain choices. But yeah, it's for different reasons. Nothing
if
like,
I'm really,
you know,
deep kind of.
Yeah, it was always kind of quite arbitrary. I knew I wanted, you know, a rainbow palette of characters, basically.
Yeah, and they work well. They look good.
Yeah, they look fantastic.
Yeah.
What about the names and personalities?
The names were generally childhood friends, or just names of friends. But most of them were kids I went to school with, and loosely related to who they were. So, you know, John, I was bullied by a kid called John, so he became the arrogance jock kind of character. My kind of one of my first loves in primary school was a girl called Laura. So there were little snippets there of kind of names that meant something to me. And then just kind of, I don't know, it's like naming a kid. Like, there was just, after I'd come up with a personality, there was just names that made sense.
Yeah.
Claire, the superhero, was intentionally, I tried to choose the girl's name that sounded least heroic. Like, I liked the idea of Claire. To me, is quite it's a pretty name. It's a friendly name. It doesn't say superhero. So therefore, and she actually comments on it that Claire's a rubbish superhero name and she needs to invent an alter ego in order to kind of solve that problem. So again, no one size fits all solution, but often either named for people I knew or kind of to suit the personality of the character.
You touched upon it earlier at the talk, which the people listening to the podcast aren't privy to, but are there any shapes you cut out of the game?
Yes, so the one that I always use an example is a character called Sam. There is a Sam in the final game, but there was a different Sam who was in it originally, and he was useless. That was the whole point of that character, was he couldn't jump, which meant that he always ended a level lower than he started. Like, he was always just going to fall through a level. And I thought that was cool. I thought the idea of a character who was just a burden would be really funny. And you could have a lot of fun with characters having to get him from one end of a level to another, and how that would affect the relationship. But inevitably, actually, when we got it into the game, it very quickly became a case of, wow, this is just a character you don't want to play as. You don't want to experience this. Mm-hmm. Chris is bad enough. Chris is kind of useless in a lot of the puzzles. So Sam, because he literally couldn't jump at all, it became frustrating to play as him, so he got cut. Even though it was a cool story beat, it was cool to have that character, it didn't work gameplay-wise, so he had to go.
Okay. And that brings us to where we are now, I guess.
Yes.
Thomas is released on the iPad.
It is, finally, yes. And everything else previously.
Yes.
It's 2 years since the first, like, the PC version came out. And yes, we just launched the iPad version, which has been an interesting experience.
Really? How's it doing?
It's doing really well. We launched it at $9 on the App Store, which is a brave move. Because,
yes.
I'm not a big fan of the scary decrease in price on iPad, that you look at games and everything's either free or a couple of dollars. I don't think that's fair on developers. I don't think that's kind of the way to go. So we decided to launch it at the exact same price it was everywhere else. But it did surprisingly well. You know, we were in the top 10 in the UK for the opening week. We made the top 20 in America, which for a niche game about rectangles, actually, I was pretty happy with. That's pretty cool. It was a good launch. We're going to keep going with it and see how that kind of long tail works. So that was the thing on PC and console with Thomas Was Alone, was it never did amazingly in its first week, but it's always kind of found a new audience and constantly been shared and kind of gone on. So we had a very good launch on iPad, but it's going to be really interesting to see now how it goes and how that kind of, how the business goes from this point on, with kind of repeat sales and people coming to the game later.
Have you had a lot of people kind of tweet at you and say, like, oh, I just got it on iPad, because I always wanted it on iPad, even though I usually play it on PC? Or
yeah, it's been really exciting. Well, the more interesting ones are the ones from people saying, I don't have anything else and I was waiting to play it.
Yeah.
And we're getting a lot of those, and it's very cool. The idea of anyone playing something I made is amazing. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's this audience coming in who are finding the game for the first time is just it's awesome. It's exactly what I want. So yeah, so far so good.
Thanks, man. And I guess that brings us on to the new game you're working mm-hmm. on, Volumes. Beginning of
yes.
games. Do you want people to play?
Yes, hopefully. It's coming along. I'm interested to see how the audience finds it. It's probably now kind of start of next year it'll be coming out, which is a bit later than I say it was. But yeah, it's coming along. It's a good game. I want it to be an excellent game before we release it. The crucial thing is going to be how people who like Thomas Was Alone will react, because it's quite a hardcore stealth game. It's not an easy platformer like Thomas was. So it's gonna be cool seeing how much, if any, of the audience Thomas Was Alone comes over, and how much it's gonna have to find its own audience.
Yeah. Can you tell us about the game for those of you
sure.
podcast listeners who maybe don't know?
Yeah, so it's a stealth game. So stealth game is you sneak around basically. It's a kind of a futuristic retelling of Robin Hood. The idea of if Robin Hood was born nowadays, how would he be? What would he do? And my answer to that question is he would become a YouTuber. He would become a show-off online. He would tell the world about how clever he was and kind of demonstrate how to do crimes online, which is quite an interesting angle on the Robin Hood story. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, you sneak around kind of showing the world how to rob from the rich.
Okay.
That's a really nice concept.
I think so. I hope
yeah,
so.
The modern twist on it. Yeah, it's cool.
Well, that's
idea.
The thing with Robin Hood was Robin Hood, in a lot of the stories, he's not really trying to help anyone. He's just trying to look clever.
Mm.
And to me now, you know, someone wanting to look clever is going to go on YouTube or social media and kind of try and make a name for themselves.
Yeah, modern. And modern in its aesthetic as well. Looking at it, it seems to be you've retained that same stylistic approach you used on Thomas. You know, you see that as one of your trademarks. Is it something you wish to continue in the future?
It's something I'm into. I'm very much into kind of minimalism and clean, sharp colors and shapes. That's because I'm kind of got a bit of a graphic design background, so I'm kind of into that stuff anyway.
Yeah.
And geometry and stuff like that. Another key part of it, honestly, is budget. Is that, you know, I haven't got the Watch Dogs money to throw around. I need to make games that are more humble in their graphic style. So what's great about Volume is Volume takes place, it's one room. This guy basically breaks into a military training simulator, which is in one location, and then uses it to create reproductions in low res of various real world locations.
Yeah.
Which means that I have a guy called Wayne Peters, who's done all the environment art for these virtual environments, who's basically a PS1 era game artist who's been able to come in and do me PlayStation 1 graphics, basically.
That's great.
Which is cool.
They've got a real appeal to them, haven't they, PS1 graphics?
They do. When you render them nowadays, modern tech, we have kind of, it almost looks like Tron. It's kind of glowing, flat shapes.
Hmm.
Really looks appealing. Very quick to do, reasonably cheap to do, so it means that we can get, you know, lots of value out of our limited resources, which in the indie side is something you've often got to consider. You know, we're not...
Mm-hmm.
Volume's probably going to come in about, I'd say, under $250,000, which is a lot of money, but it's not, you know, the kind of money that the AAAs can throw around.
Mm. Arguably, the idea of having this really stylistic approach is more interesting than, you mentioned Watch Dogs. For me, I look at Watch Dogs and I was commenting on how nice the floor looked. How nicely rendered. It's like, that's like a photograph, Matt said. Yes, it probably is a photograph. But yeah, for me at least, that is a lot more interesting to do something stylistically. I mean, as a graphic designer as well myself, you know, it really appeals to me. One of the major strengths of indie games, isn't it, that they do have this really cool style to them.
Well, that's design. Design is constraint. Yeah. Design is about working within, and I'm sure you guys encounter this daily, it's about working creatively within very defined limitations. There are You know, and if you look at great design through the ages, it's never been. No great design has ever come of someone having unlimited resources, crazy budget, and they can use whatever materials they like.
Mm.
The great design classics have always been the result of limitations, of we can only use three colors,
or
we can only have this material, or we have to make this in, this, the production line for this has to come in under this cost.
We know this things. Very well.
Yeah, well, I imagine you have all of this stuff.
Yeah.
The minifig, designing minifigs, I mean, I don't know your job, but it seems like that is a very defined set of limitations in terms of what you can do to say something about a character. You know, if you're working with an existing character, how you can convey that in Lego language.
Mm.
So, that's great design. And I'd much rather work under those constraints and get something great out the other end, hopefully, than to have kind of, unlimited resources and hope that somehow I manage to make something good.
Am I right in remembering a quote that I'm just pulled out the back of my head, that when you released Thomas, you said it wouldn't be true for you to do pixel graphics on Thomas because it wasn't something you'd kind of grown up with?
Yeah, well, I wasn't nostalgic for it. I didn't really... I mean, I played a lot of DOS games, these kind of educational titles I was talking about. But no, for me, the nostalgic era I'm nostalgic about is PlayStation 1, is Metal Gear Solid, the original Metal Gear Solid. That's the period I'm obsessed with. That's the period that when I close my eyes and remember childhood gaming experience, it's Metal Gear Solid, Shenmue, Deus Ex.
Yeah.
So that's the stuff that I'm going to nostalgically reference. And Volume is unashamedly inspired by those games. And that shines through. But that's more truthful. Whereas, me going and making like a NES-style game, just... it would be dishonest. It wouldn't be true to my actual nostalgia. I'd be doing it because it's fashionable.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone back and tried to like dive into the archive of NES and Super Nintendo?
Sure. Play. I mean, I played Mario, obviously. You know, I've gone back and played the classics. But it's very different going back to them now. It's interesting. Pixel art is a very modern style as well. It's not, I think, for most pixel artists now, they don't see themselves as just purely nostalgic. It's a new art form. It's new stuff is being done in it. I wouldn't want to dismiss it as pure nostalgia. I find it astonishing when you look at Sam's game, and that's very pixel art. And you're like, you're 12 years old. Yeah. This is purely an aesthetic choice. Like, you have no memory. For you, you should be nostalgic for Xbox 360 games.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But it's not a choice. It's not a choice he's made because of his limited resources. It goes back to what I'm saying. Mm. He's a 12-year-old kid who can't draw.
Yeah.
So what's available to him? Well, pixel art. He can make cool little sprites and characters and do it that way. So I wouldn't want to dismiss pixel art as purely nostalgia, but for me... it does make a lot of sense. I probably will do one at some point just because I think it's a cool look and I'll probably come up with an idea that suits it. But for now, no, it's not for me.
Fair enough. So, Mike, I guess the question is, looking forward to the future, what kind of excites you about the future possibilities of video games? You've touched upon the tools being in the hands of young creators to create things, but like, is there anything tech-wise, such as VR or any new consoles or any new ideas you've seen that really excite you?
I mean, VR interests me. I'm doing a few things with VR at the moment. I've got a few prototypes kicking about that I'm playing with. It's certainly an area that intrigues me. So I'm doing some VR things. And what's going to be very interesting is when that hits consumer technology. Right now, VR is a cool toy that nerds play with.
Yeah.
I have an Oculus. I have a couple of Oculuses.
You have Oculi, maybe.
I have Oculi. There you go. I like that. Is it Oculuses or Oculi? Oculi's better, isn't it?
Please ask them. You'll get a response.
I'll have a word with them and I'll ask. So I'm interested in that stuff, but it's just going to be interesting if whether the broad audience is. That's going to be fun. Other than that, honestly, just the continued democratization of platforms is very cool. The kind of the way that that's spreading out and more people are playing these games and making these games, and that you can basically now make a game and bring it to any platform without a publisher is interesting. And it's gonna be cool seeing how the dust settles on that and how we as an industry kind of work from that. But it's all good.
Yeah. She talked about this earlier. My brother works in the music industry, and I think it's a very great point that you're bringing up, a kind of like it's unfair to developers to have games for free on the App Store, and you charging $9 on the App Store, to me, seems fair. You've put the work into the game, why shouldn't you see the reward?
I think it's the developer's choice. Yes. I would never tell a developer how to price their own game, but it does seem that we've all kind of lent towards a lower number, which is, I think, a shame.
Yeah. But with the publishing thing, at least I know from the music industry, with this lack of publishers needed, it's kind of dismantled the music industry as a whole. Like, there is no filter anymore, to use the term that is being thrown around by them. Like, there is just an onslaught of things. How do you think that games developers can get cured when it is at this point, when everyone can publish games and everyone can...
I do still believe that good stuff rises.
Of course.
I do still believe that when someone makes something really noteworthy, it does find an audience. I think there's people who like to seek out cool new stuff and like to talk about that new stuff and spread the word. So there's that. Honestly, it's old school marketing stuff. It's getting coverage, getting people and opinion makers to talk about your game, building up that kind of reputation, that audience. It's honestly how it used to be. There was this moment, these kind of about 4 or 5 years, I guess from kind of Braid to probably Thomas Was Alone was one of the last games, where Steam, just being on Steam, made you a hit.
Yeah.
And kind of was instant financial success to be on Steam. And a lot of us benefited from that because it was such a closed system that you being on Steam meant something to players, and they went, wow, that's a game Valve thinks is good. And it was kind of an almost a guaranteed success.
Yeah, almost just like the Nintendo seal of quality.
Yeah,
PC.
And we've moved beyond that now, and that effect doesn't happen. Which I think in the short term is scary. There's a lot of people from kind of my generation of indies who look at that and go, wow, that the old way, the way I know to succeed, doesn't work anymore. But I actually think that's kind of exciting as well, because it means that new curators will appear, new people will get to decide. For a long time, Valve has decided what is a hit and what isn't. I'm quite excited to see who we elect in this democratic world to be our hit makers. It seems at the moment to be the YouTubers, which is an interesting first step, but I think there's going to be lots of people from lots of different areas kind of coming in and doing cool things.
Well, I guess, you know, things like Kickstarter as well, and people being allowed to vote with their wallets and saying, yeah, I'll give you $40 to make this. Like, this is awesome. I really like this concept. Yeah, and I guess that brings us to the end of it, Mike. Cool. If you would like to plug your wares, then...
Yes, so everyone should buy Thomas Was Alone. It's rather good. It's on PC, Mac, Linux, PlayStation Vita, PS3, the iPad, probably some new places by the time this comes out. Our volume's coming up, so keep an eye on that. Follow me on Twitter at Mike Bithell, BITHELL, and buy Space Pants, because that's really good.
Yes. Hashtag Space Pants.
Hashtag
game.
Space Pants game. Let's make that happen.
We should. And you can find us at the usual places, facebook.com/TomandMattAttack. We're on Twitter 24/7 at TMAcast. And please give us a cheeky rate and subscribe in iTunes. And you can listen to us in Stitcher too. Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time out and talking to us.
Thank you for talking to me. It's
Thank
been
you,
a lot
Mike.
Of fun.
And until next time, guys, game on.
Game on.